Let the House Health Education and Social Services Committee come to order, please. Let the record show that this is Friday, March 16th, 1984. The hearing is being held in the Capitol Building in Juneau in room 112. Time is 17 minutes after 1 p.m. in the afternoon. Members of the committee present is Pessinger, Kopanen, Davis, and Tischer. On the calendar today, we have consideration of House Bill 681, which is an act related to default and collection of student loans, and the consideration of House Bill 566, an act related to training of teachers and principals on the subject of sexual abuse of minors. In addition, we are considering House Concurrent Resolution 46, which is related to background checks on school employees who are in contact with children. I'd like to welcome all of you who came to testify or observe, and note that we will be electronically recorded, so if you are here to testify, please to remember to state your name. If you have any interest in any of the bills that are before us today, there are sign-up sheets in the room. We'd appreciate it if you put your names down on the sign-up sheet so that we can call you for testimony or your comments when we hear those bills. First on the agenda is House Bill 681. Members of the committee, we have in your file a committee substitute draft, and for the purposes of deliberation, I'd ask a motion to place the committee substitute before the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would move that we consider a committee substitute for House Bill 681. I believe it's dated February 29th, 1984, as the item for business during today's hearing.
Are there objections? Hearing none. Yes, Mr. Are you objecting?
I'm not really objecting. I'm just curious what the change was.
We can discuss the change are no objections to the motion.
No objections.
So moved then. The difference between the original and the committee substitute, Mr. Davis, is that on the bottom it's really technical changes that were done by drafting, and take a look down on the bottom of page one. You'll notice
I think you're looking at the wrong bill.
They're marked on your copy there so that you can see. Okay? They're merely technical changes. Does that satisfy you, Mr. Davis?
Sure.
Okay, very good. First on our list for testimony is Mr. Kerry Romsberg. Kerry, would you please come forward? And you'll be electronically recorded, so please state your name for the record.
Thank you. I'm Kerry Romsberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and I would like to encourage the passage of this bill. Let me explain very briefly what the bill does. Right now we have the situation where the law for the student loan program indicates that all receipts that are collected from student loan collections must be placed into the revolving fund and used solely for additional student loans. We have a problem with defaulted loans currently, and one that promises to get even worse in the future. We would like to turn those loans over to a private collection agency, and in so doing, the private collectors would like to charge a certain set percentage of what they collect. Normally that's somewhere between 25 to as much as 50%, depending on who gets the bid and what all is involved. What happens is, if an individual goes after someone that owes this money, owes the state the debt, they can add the cost of collections to what that individual owes and then recover it as the money comes in. That would be the normal way it would happen. In our case, if an individual owes $1,000 and someone charges $200 to collect it, they say, all right, now you owe us $1,200. Even if we collect $1,200, it has to go into the revolving fund and be used only for loans. We would like to be able to allow that extra money to be used for paying these individuals that do go after defaulted accounts. To do so, we would need a change, and that change is in section 1 on pages 12 through 14 of the the amended version, and you'll notice it adds the language to pay costs of collecting student loans that are in default that are not recovered from the student. So it allows us to go ahead and use that money that does come in to pay for the cost of collections. The other two parts of this bill, Sections 2 and Section 3, involve a trigger that happens when an account becomes 120 days past due, which is our definition of default. What happens at that time is, instead of a 5% loan, the loan will automatically become a 10% loan. And the second thing that happens is Section 3, they would lose all of their forgiveness benefits. So if an individual allows their account to become 4 months past due, they lose the 5% interest benefit, they lose the forgiveness benefit. Those two sections would apply for all loans made from this point forward. We can't go back and change it for those in the past, even though I would certainly like to do that. And those are the three changes that are incorporated. There is a fiscal note with the bill. It takes a little explanation in that it's a zero fiscal note. The reason it's zero is really on the second page, and it shows like the first, for example, the first year, it would be as much as $120,000 would be the cost. However, that would be borne by the individual that owed us the money. So we show it as an extra receipt of $120,000 and then a payout of $120,000, and the difference is zero. There will be some money generated in the future from the additional interest that's charged, but that won't come on until about 1988 or 89. So there's zero fiscal note for the next 3 years, and then small impact in the future, and then growing from that point on.
Mr. Romsberg, if there's an increase from 5% to 10% on default like that, the additional 5% that is earned, does that equate to approximately the same amount of money that a private agency would charge to collect?
Not on the interest. The charge that the private agency would collect would just be added on to the debt, and it's just an additional add-on. Instead of, for instance, the example used, if you owed $9,000 and they charged 33%, you would owe another $3,000. Your debt to the state would then be $12,000, and as it came in, for every payment we received, the private collector would get the 30% or the 33%, and they would get one payment each time also, and that's the way it would work. The 5% trigger really comes, the governor, when looking at this, felt that 5% interest is quite low, and if an individual, if we have to chase the individual and pursue collections, that they shouldn't continue to receive that kind of a state subsidy, which it, in fact, is quite a subsidy, 5%.
Thank you. Mr. Pessinger and then Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Dr. Romsberg, I like the direction the bill is taking. I'm sure you've explored the arm of the Attorney General's office as a potential agency to collect the loans. What is the problem with the AG's office? Why do you prefer this direction, which I think does make sense? And once you're in this direction, what criteria will you use in selecting a private collection agency and compensating a private collection agency? And if you get from the private collection agency and need an attorney, will you be selecting attorneys too? And what, again, is the area of compensation that you intend for them?
Okay, thank you. The answer in terms of is there anything wrong with the Attorney General's office? No, there's not. They're giving us very good support now. What we're really talking about is we have a collection section in our agency at the current time. It consists of 7 individuals, and they simply cannot keep up with the number of accounts that are in default. So we're faced with either building a very large staff on the state payroll to do this function, or farming it out. If we put it on state payroll, obviously it's going to be a direct expense, even though there would be extra money generated, there would be an expense to the state. In terms of contracting it out, we go on a competitive bid basis. The Attorney General's office would coordinate that with us, particularly for the legal services. And we've talked with them about that. And in fact, they said that one of the things they might look at is, in effect, a bid that would work on an RSA, a reimbursable services agreement between our agencies, where they could do some of the servicing too and just have the charge on there. So we might not have to use private attorneys exclusively. They may be able to do some of the work as they continue to do.
Does the record show that Mr. Ball is present? Continue, Mr. Pessinger.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I can't speak for all collection agencies, but there's often a community practice where they will work for a percentage of the amount collected without charging a fee. Sometimes they ask for their cost only, cost of investigation. Most attorneys who do work in the area of collection do it on a contingency fee. They ask for their cost, a $50 filing fee, for example. But then they do it on a contingency fee basis. I would like to see us get involved with a practice that is in conformity with our private community. I would not like to see us overcompensate either collection agencies or attorneys. I can think of contracts that have gone out because of the state name where we've simply paid 5 and 10 times the market. And I would not, this is an excellent idea. I agree with everything you say, and we also ought to get a good solid rate from rather than get hit, and that we mean it. I was looking at the a draft of the corporate code where we paid an individual approximately $250,000. The Alaska American Bar Association has a model code that they would have given us for $15. I know many people in the private business that when the state comes in and bid, they wink, and it doubles and it triples and it quadruples, and there's no reason we can't get this at a comparable rate. So I'd be curious, and I'll be quiet because I should ask you questions, but I really mean it. This is good direction, it's good efficiency cost collection, but we ought not to be gouged when we engage this service. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Are you asking what guarantees we have that there won't be that sort of thing for Mr. Romsberg? And if you didn't ask, I'll ask, as long as we've gone on the subject.
The only guarantee we have is that we would be using a competitive bid basis.
Okay.
And hopefully that would be taken care of. I can tell you that there is a great deal of interest, particularly from the collection community, and there is a collection agency or a organization within the state of Alaska of private collectors. There's a great deal of interest on their part, as well as a number of attorneys that have indicated that they would like to bid for this service also. So I think it will be pretty competitive, and
okay.
That's the best hedge we can get.
Mr. Davis?
Thank you. I know when the commissions first started off, there was a pretty high delinquency rate, and then it went way down. And is the reason why that it's on the rise now is perhaps because of the amount of loans and that you don't have the staff to keep up with? Is that the part of the reason why?
That's it. There are a couple reasons. One, of course, is the fact you can borrow more money, and the larger the debt, that tends to force people into problems with paying. But the principal reason is, right now, for instance, there are 2,000, let me give you the correct number here, 2,711 people. This was as of the 1st of March, 2,711 people. There were 120 days past due. A few years ago when we were looking at this, we were talking in terms of hundreds of people, and we could get a handle on it. But now we're faced, as I was saying, we're faced with either increasing staff greatly or else doing something else. And it's just the workload. It really isn't so much that Alaskans have suddenly decided not to pay their loans. That's not the case. It's just work volume.
You just got more loans, too.
Yes.
Hey, Mr. Davis.
Yes, he just has a couple more committees of referrals. So I just have one final question, and this has to do with your thing that you request for bids, and you have under your exhibits. You have the people's, are these actual students' names that you have in here in this exhibit? You have names?
Yes.
And there's social security numbers. I didn't know that was public record. You could put somebody's name and social security number out.
It's public record.
It's because it's in court action.
Sure. Now, in terms of this program, it is one of the programs where it's all public record. The Attorney General has given us a ruling on that a few years ago when the press had wanted access to it. And at the time, I didn't think it was, but
Your social security numbers?
Their entire account, and the social security number is part of it. That's their identifier in this case.
All right. That's all I have. Thank you very much.
Mr. Romsberg, I have before me a March 16th, 1984 letter from the Attorney General's office. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The Attorney General, or Assistant Attorney General Art Peterson, make some recommendations to revise the existing committee substitute which we have before us for clarification. And I believe, does everyone have a copy of that in their file?
Yes.
Okay. At the bottom of page 1 of the letter, indicates some changes that they're suggesting that the committee make in order to more clarify. And if you're familiar with that, Mr. Omsley, perhaps you'd like to discuss it with us.
The principal suggestion that Art Peterson has listed in here is, as the current committee substitute has default defined in two sections of the bill, defined the same way in both sections. And Art Peterson was indicating that it's, in his judgment, it's better if it's defined in one place in the bill, because in some future date, if the legislature goes in and amends one section, they may forget to amend it in another, and you can end up with conflicting statutes.
Correct.
So he felt it should be defined in one place. And that's principally what he's saying in this memo.
That's a good suggestion for the committee to take under advisement. In anticipation of that, staff has put down some language that, if you don't already have, Mr. Rumsford, will be coming to you very shortly. And if you please examine that to see what you think about it.
That looks fine to me, yes. I think that would satisfy what Mr. Peterson indicated was a problem. Mm-hmm.
Time to examine that, and perhaps Mr. Pesterby, I'll entertain a motion to include those as amendments to the committee substitute at this time.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess we all have before us the suggested language. It's stated March 16th, 84 in the upper right-hand corner, lines 20. I would move that we amend the committee substitute before us to where we, on lines 24 to 26, page 1, delete the language as shown. On line 29, page 1, line 1, page 2, delete the language as shown. But at line 6, page 2, Alaska 14.43.120 is amended by adding a new subsection to read. It's section Q. For purposes of this section, a loan is in default if a loan payment is 120 or more days past due. I would ask unanimous consent to the amendment.
Are there objections to the motion? Hearing none, so moved. Thank you very much, Mr. Rumsford. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify for House Bill 681? Hearing none, are there comments of the members in regards to this bill? Hearing none, I'd ask for a motion to move the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would move committee substitute for House Bill 681 Hess, that it be moved from committee with individual recommendations in the applicable fiscal note.
Are there objections to the motion? Hearing none, so moved. Now before us, we have the next item on the agenda is House Bill 566, an act related to training teachers and principals on the subject of sexual abuse of minors. The principal sponsor is here, and we would invite her to come forward and make comments if she so desired at this time. Ms. Locker, electronically recorded, so please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Barbara Locker, representative from the Mexico Borough District 16CA. I have briefly testified on these bills before the committee before, and so what I would ask today is that you allow me to sit at the table and listen to the testimony and possibly ask questions and work with the many people that are here who hope to improve this legislation.
Please join us. We're off the second hearing, so it looks a little warm. Let the record show that Representative Ewing is present.
Let the record show at this point the number of Republicans equals the number of Democrats.
We have a new member on the committee?
Yeah.
Yes, didn't you know?
Well, I'm glad to be sitting next to...
Mr. Ewing, we are on House Bill 566.
So we can make the quorum easier.
Sponsor of the bill has been invited to sit at the table to discuss the matter with us. We have a good number of people who'd like to testify on this bill. And we'll call Steve Holt to the table, please, for his comments.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Steve Holt from the Department of Education. State Board considered House Bill 566, and while it has generally expressed support for the notion that something like this needs to occur, the Board is opposed to the absolute requirement of there being 2 days of in-service training provided each year for this purpose. Indeed, the Board would probably object to that kind of dedication of school time for any purpose. I think the Board would probably approve something that just required training be provided to school district employees, or that school districts develop and have submitted, or develop and have approved by the commissioner, a plan for which provides for in-service training for this purpose, or each school district provide for in-service training within a year of the effective date and then submit a plan for the training of new employees to the district. But the Board is opposed to, and would, I'm sure, continue to oppose anything that requires school time to this extent on an annual basis.
Mrs. Locker, you have a question, Mr. Hall?
Yes, I would like to ask Mr. Hall if he is representing the Department of Education, the Commissioner, or the State Board with his testimony.
All of the above.
Okay. In that case, Madam Chairman, I would draw the attention of the body to the letter that came from Commissioner Reynolds, dated March 2, 1984, where he responds to this legislation with, "Legislation which you have sponsored regarding required in-service training for teachers is an excellent idea, although it would be the department's recommendation to require it on an every other basis instead of annually. If such an in-service was required, it would be extremely beneficial if the Department of Education were able to develop an in-service training package," and he goes on to say that there would be a modest sum required. So I would suggest that this letter, and I can give it to you, Madam Chairman, in its entirety, is fully supportive of this legislation, and just simply makes a recommendation that maybe every other year would not be something that they could totally support, which certainly appears to be different than what Mr. Hall has just related to us.
Mr. Hall, you want to respond?
Madam Chairman. Unless I'm mistaken, that letter was written prior to the Board meeting. And I want to reemphasize, the Board and the Department and the Commissioner are fully supportive of training for this purpose. There's no question about that. The only question that does exist is how you go about it. It was the Board's position that districts do provide that training, but that 2 days, 1 day, 3 days not be required, but that it be done in a more site or district specific fashion, whatever is appropriate to that place.
Mr. Hall, how many in-service days are required for a school district to have?
None, Madam Chair.
Total. There is no requirement by law, by statute, or by policy, or by regs?
No, ma'am.
Mr. Gall?
Thank you. Let me just, first of all, are you familiar with committee substitute?
Yes, sir.
So that responds to the biennial, but my concern would be that maybe this is not really what was intended, even if it is what was recommended. To have this every other year, of course, means that new teachers will not, except in their second year, necessarily be availed of this training. A new teacher on an off year would go 1 year without the training.
That's correct, is the way I read the CS.
And then the other issue that's been raised is the dedication of 2 days of in-service training. My own personal feeling would be that it should be each year, and I agree with you that structuring the language so that it is sufficiently thorough that we can be assured that there will be a adequate amount of training, while at the same time not compelling the school to spend 2 days on the program, which really would not be so necessary after the first year of training for any individual, all makes a great deal of sense to me. I wondered if you would choose among your choices and recommend specific language, at least for me to consider, that would address the 2 points, number one, or three really. Number one, that the training be annual. Number two, that the program be approved by the department. And number three, that the scheduling and structuring of the program be compatible with the standards that are imposed upon school systems today. Do you have any recommendations along those lines, or could you maybe return to us in 15 minutes with recommendations or something?
Mr. Paul?
I may, Madam Chairman. Language, well, before I will address your concern, with respect to the committee substitute, there is some question as to the effect or the intent of the words in the committee substitute in terms of whether the in-service training is part of the 180-day school year or if it's training which is required in addition to 180 days. That is not made clear by the language in the committee substitute.
Mr. Ho, I have before me, and Mr. Gall, a copy of the statutes, section 1403030. Says, school term. The school term begins and ends on the dates fixed by the governing body of the school district. However, the term shall include not less than 180 days in session, except that, subject to the approval of the commissioner, a day service for in-service training of teachers may be substituted for a day in session, up to a maximum of 10 days. I interpret that as meaning that, although not required, the school boards are allowed to take up to 10 days.
That's correct.
Would you not say that the existing statute would apply here?
It could. I would point out, Madam Chairman, the reason for my question is that there are a variety of different kinds of in-service training that are in addition to 180 days. That is, they're at cost to the district, but not within the 180-day school term required by law.
Correct. Could you give us some ideas of what those in-service training days are used for?
Reading instruction.
Reading instruction to whom?
Teachers. How to teach reading better. Staff development of a variety of different kinds. I'd have to be more specific than that, I'd have to go to individual school districts and find out what, for instance, Anchorage requires in its 188-day school contract of teachers.
I guess the reason I'm going to ask that, Mr. Ho, is that it's my impression, although I'm not sure, and you can verify this, that as you just mentioned, those things that you just mentioned that may be subject for an in-service day are kind of continuing education types of things, some of which would have been or should have been or were taught in the teacher's normal curriculum as they were taking their schooling. I doubt very much if sexual and child abuse was part of that schooling, and I think the sponsor here is saying that since there was none and there was no training during their courses, that this, because it becomes such an issue and such a very delicate issue and such a very important one to our children, that making 2 in-service days mandatory on this particular issue at this time would do our children a heck of a lot of good. That's what you're saying.
If I may, Madam Chairman, I don't dispute that. And I believe it's the intent of the legislation to make that within that 10-day provision that 2 of them must be on this topic. I don't think there's any question as the intent. All I'm saying is it can be interpreted a couple of different ways. and it could be clarified in the committee substitute. If I may, with respect to Representative Gall's question, language which said each school district shall provide in-service training of teachers and principals on the subjects of child abuse and sexual abuse of minors each school year or every other school year or what else might be appropriate would accommodate at least one of our concerns. And that is...
Say that again, please.
Beginning on line 12, scratch everything, scratch the first clause on a biennial basis.
First of all, excuse me, Mr. Cole, I neglected to ask for a motion to consider the committee substitute, so right now we don't have that before us, so I'm going to interrupt at this time to ask for a motion to consider the committee substitute so that we can operate on it.
I would object.
I'll adopt.
Mr. Ewing?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll move and ask unanimous consent that we adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 566 that's before us.
Objections?
First, no, actually, I would. Well, first of all, I did object.
You did object?
Yes, I certainly did.
Your objection, sir?
No, I'm going to withdraw my objection.
Very well.
I'm just advising you that I did object, but I'm withdrawing my objection.
Very good.
Now we have.
Other objections? So moved. Now we have the committee substitute before us, and please continue, Mr. Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. One way to approach it, certainly not the only way, is to simply have a bill which says each school district shall provide in-service training to its teachers and principals mm-hmm. on the subjects of child abuse and sexual abuse of minors.
Could I follow up on that question?
Sure, Mr. Goldberg.
Thank you very much. How about this, Steve? Each school district shall provide annual in-service training, because now we've eliminated the 2 days requirement, annual in-service training of teachers and principals on the subject of sexual abuse of minors. And then you had a recommendation as to how to be sure that that would not be merely, okay, teachers, here is our 5-minute annual sexual abuse of minors training, don't do it, class dismissed. How would you phrase the suggestion you made that department approval or something like that? I don't know. Did you have some language for that?
Well, the one way, depending upon the level of legislative competence in the department, if I may, Madam Chairman, is to require the department to implement the section by regulation.
I would certainly object to that, Mr. Hull, so that's nothing that we want to discuss in this meeting.
Okay, then, Madam Chair, could you suggest to me, just for the sake of argument, of course,
sure.
only, let's just pretend, if we could, that we were to follow Mr. Hull's recommendation and it were to say, loosen the language here a little bit, insofar as it doesn't require a particular time period, but does require that the training be implemented. Would you have any recommendations on how to ensure best that the training be adequate to meet what I think we all agree is a very serious need?
Yes, Mr. Gall, I think I can answer that. The language, as you see in committee substitute, is a nice, tight piece of legislation. If you loosen it up and then try to tighten it up, I don't know what the objection
is. Let me be very clear. We're not trying to loosen up the requirement that the training be conducted. Saying that we should substitute 2 days of training for 2 days of teaching in itself will not make the program good. It will possibly, in fact, take those school systems who maybe there's no turnover in their teachers for a couple of years, and they'll be forced under this language to, if you'll forgive me, waste 2 days of teaching time to repeat a program which they may have had the year before or 2 years before. So I think the idea was just to say, yes, you must provide this training. Yes, you must schedule sufficient time to do it. And the training must do such and such or be such and so or something, so that we're saying what we want them to do rather than just how long we want them to do it. That's the only point of my question.
I think I could respond to that and kind of make a correlation here, Mr. Gall.
Please.
And that is, first of all, repetition never hurt anyone when it comes to such a critical issue. I think that we have repetition in our in-service days as it is on less critical issues, in my estimation, and perhaps in the sponsor's estimation, I think probably in your mind also, that I think priority here is the issue. So where you are placing priority on reading instruction for the teachers and so forth, which is certainly good for our students and would certainly multiply itself 12 or 50-fold, depending on how many students that teacher teaches. Certainly the precautionary measures that are noted in this kind of training for the teachers to be aware of, to observe and teach those, you know, if you get it once, do you remember it? If you get it twice, do you remember it better? And if you get it once a year, twice, you always remember it. So I guess that's what I'm saying. Until sexual and child abuse issues, incidents diminish in our young children, I think, in my estimation, that we are doing service to our children. If later on we find it not necessary, I'd be tickle pink to come back and
I certainly agree with your philosophy on this. And frankly, if the bill goes as written, I have no objection. The only concern I have is to try to make it as good and productive a bill as possible. For example, I would tend to think that one full day of training annually would serve the purpose more effectively than two full days of training every other year. But what I think is really at issue here is that just because, you know, if you're a teacher in a school, you have to be able to identify child abuse and you have to be able to respond to child abuse. And the ability to identify is something which can be, you can get training in that fairly quickly. The problem of response is a much more delicate and difficult matter. And I think what will really happen here will, or the effect of what happens here as a result of this will be an effect based upon how well the school system organizes its response network to child abuse, such that when a teacher says, geez, child is coming in black and blue on a regular basis, what is the school going to do? Not what is the school going to know how to do, but, you know, will that principal, will that superintendent have the courage to create what could be a very dangerous political issue in his community or her community?
Representative Locker has a response.
I'm sure, but if I could just finish
my
comment.
I'm sorry, I
didn't finish. That organizing the response network, you know, is a very important thing. So anyway, I guess maybe I am done. I just think that a two-day training program every other year may not be the best way to go. If the committee determines that that's what they want to put out of committee, I have no objection. But I see what the department, or at least the board, is saying, that dedicating those 2 days may not be the solution. There may be other verbal solutions that would serve the intent of the sponsor as well or better. I would just hope we could continue to explore them for a few minutes.
Barbara?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Gall is as concerned with this issue, I can tell by his questions, as I am. What he does not have before him today is all the legislation that has been introduced, and we're not trying to do everything in this one bill. Several of the people have said, well, what about the money to implement it? We need to add money to this. Well, the representative has in this committee the bill that actually appropriates the money for Department of Education to develop a program and implement the program. So we have actually researched the subject and have introduced separate pieces of legislation that attack it the best way we know how. So we're not trying to do all of that in one bill. Second to that, I realize that the Department of Education does not feel that 2 days every year are necessary. We have some other people, such as the administrators, who think that maybe every other year would do it. In my best judgment, 2 days per year is what's necessary. I hope to get any part of that, and that will be up to this committee. But if we're trying to address the problem as good as I think we should, it would be 2 days every year, like the representative, the chairman said. It is such a serious issue that for now, let's really address it. And if there comes a time where these cases begin to diminish, and we can take another look at it. But that's where I'm coming from. Now, I was told when this happened in our community by someone who would know, I don't know what the big deal is. This happens in at least one district per year in this state.
What does?
So sexual abuse of minors in a school district related to school children and or teachers or some other school employee.
Hundreds of times per
year
per district in the state.
Well, I can only tell you that with that sort of response, then anything we can do to attack the problem needs to be done. And I'm just saying that if you'll have a little faith, we're not doing it all in this bill.
Could I just ask the representative to elaborate? She mentioned the funding. What else is being done that you feel would round this out?
Yeah.
Sorry.
We have them in order, and they're coming.
I'd like to know what they are.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Barbara, tell them.
Okay, well, number one, the hearsay evidence bill, which we have already heard.
Okay.
Number two, making it mandatory for principals and teachers to attend this in-service, where right now many of the districts do provide it, but it's not mandatory, hasn't been. And number three, providing money through another bill, through the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, to raise public's consciousness. And there's a fourth bill. What is it? There's four. The DOE appropriation, these two. And the background checks. And I think that we have addressed it, but certainly if this committee chooses to rewrite, you know, the sexual abuse laws and actually attack this problem, it's probably something that the chairman would like to do in the interim, I'll bet.
Representative Pessinger, and then you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Holt, sometimes I try to listen, not sometimes, I always try to listen to people in my district, and they raised a couple issues on this. I noticed that in the intent, it talks about, I just have intent of legislation here, it talks about school personnel are the most likely group to see physical and behavioral indicators in children which signal sexual abuse. And because of how many hours children spend in the classroom, teachers are in a key position to know their students and to build relationships which would allow them to assist a child in a crisis situation. One teacher raised this concern. Do we need legal immunity for teachers if we involve ourselves and we're wrong and the family brings a very significant, expensive piece of litigation against the teacher? If a teacher involved herself and was wrong, you could talk a 6- or 7-figure suit real easy. So do we need some concepts of legal immunity for a teacher? And how do you see this log? I like your philosophy on this. How do you see this approach as interacting with the family and the school? Where do you see what I'm saying? Is there that was a teacher's concern, was wanting legal immunity. I had a parent's concern that was concerned with familial rights. Do you see these as, how do you assess these in relation to what we're doing here?
If I may, Madam Chairman, Representative Pessinger, you're asking for a personal philosophy. I don't object to giving you that. I just want you to recognize that what you're about to hear is me, not necessarily the department. I think it would be tragic, or at least ill-conceived, to view any kind of training related to sexual abuse of the minor without also providing training for the reporting requirements in another title related to abuse of a youngster. In other words, in approaching the subject, there are at least two issues that have to be dealt with, that is, those surrounding sexual abuse of a minor and the legal requirements imposed upon the professionals as to what they have to do if they suspect that that kind of abuse exists. And they're very clearly required by law to report any suspected cases of child abuse, and to fail to do so is a Class B misdemeanor. I think you have to approach both of those. And you have to do it in the context of the folks that have the knowledge and the day-to-day experience in dealing with those kinds of issues. That is, health and social services people, education people, and professionals who counsel those who have been involved in those kinds of incidents.
Do you see any need for any kind of legal immunity, or do you know if it exists? Is that any problem, or am I being impractical?
It's my understanding that, as a practical matter, it exists.
Okay.
Mr. Ewing?
Just a couple things here. I think that possibly if we were to change what we've got on between line 12 and line 15, and we would go, and I'll just throw this out for the committee, on a annual basis, each school district shall include during the school term one day of in-service training of teachers and principals on the subjects of child abuse and sexual abuse of minors. Is there a specific reason for putting the biennial in there? Is there a reason for that? You would agree to that? I think it'd be simpler if we were, instead of going on this biannual basis, it would be easier just to do it on an annual basis, because what conceivably could happen is that those 2 days could be jammed up into one particular year, unless I'm not reading that right. But let's, if we make it a little bit more simple, I'd be willing to put that together so that.
I guess let me just give you my presumption here, although I'm not sure about this. There are times if you have 2 days together, and what if three teachers in a large school district are sick? They miss out both days. But if they are one in January and one in September, you're apt to catch them all. Perhaps that was the intent, so that it doesn't necessarily happen back to back, but at least there's two separate days, so that if you miss once, you catch them the second time around.
Yeah, but it's 2 days every 2 years, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying, if it's 2 days every, what I'm saying is that,
oh, I see.
I'm saying the frequency of it isn't going to do any good if the 2 days fall into the second year. I mean, someone's going to forget about it, I mean, 18 to 19 months later. So if you establish that there's, let's say, 1 year or 1 day out of each year, then you'll catch them each year, and then you won't have to go through this.
Do you want to hold off on that until
sure.
we get the rest of our
the
people here? There's other folks here that want to testify, which may have an impact
sure.
on any of the things that we're later on going to deliberate about. Did you have one more question, Mr. Gall, or shall we go on?
Well, just...
I got seven more people testifying.
I can wait.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Gall. Mr. McKinnon, please. You're being electronically recorded. Mr. McKinnon, so please state your name for the record.
My name is Don McKinnon. I'm with the Alaska Council of School Administrators, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. I just came back from the Assistant Principals Conference. I had some concerns about it. First of all, I want to commend the sponsors of the bill and the legislature for the work that they are trying to do in this area. And my members are extremely supportive of the bills. We do have a problem with the very same thing the State Board of Education does, and that's the 2 days mandated in there. We raised the question, you know, I've heard your clarification, it's within the 180 days. And so if that's what you're talking about, that will in fact cause, for some districts, may or may not cause some problems. But I want the committee to realize that most districts don't use those 10 days. The public won't let them use those 10 days. Because once you start sending with this thing and said this is going to be the highest priority by the legislature, and you may have districts in a variety of in-services. A district may be working on developing the middle school complex and be doing a lot of things like that, and so they've got people in there. So we have a feeling that the local has a need to be able to control the amount of the in-service. We, particularly with school districts today being told that one of the things that we need to do is get kids back in the classroom and keep them in the classroom and time on task, and we are now having indicated more of those in-services. So we have a question about that. We have a question about the size of the districts that 2 days is necessarily, it would be necessary. I would use, for example, a Pelican. Pelican may have three teachers. They could run an in-service, and they certainly wouldn't need 2 days to in-service their teachers. And if those teachers don't turn over, they would only have to have some occasional refreshing. And I'm going to speak a little bit to that a little bit. But one of the problems that if you mandate the 2 days in there, and teachers have had it over a period of time, I have conducted and had to work with lots of in-service, and you get a burnout factor in there, and you lose their attention, and it's less than productive. And so I think district can address that thing, and I would like to take my experience in Juneau for just a minute as a superintendent there, because I happen to have a copy of their policy manuals in there. But about 4 years ago, we got into this. We didn't make the newspapers, but we got into the middle of this, and I became aware of it. I've also become aware that as an administrator in other districts, that this is an issue, and it has been an issue, and it isn't that districts aren't dealing with it. And I think that's one of the things that needs to be understood. We found that we had to set up a policy that gave a clear direction and train the teachers how to use it, particularly on child abuse, and I commend that you've added that back into the bill, because when I first saw the first one, I was going to ask that that be amended, and you'd already done it, so somebody got their way ahead of me. The child abuse and sexual abuse of minors, but we found the situation, like Steve Holt pointed out, we had the state troopers come into one of our buildings where we had a problem, and he was going to charge the teacher. We weren't aware that the teacher had a reporting procedure to do, and that there was the process to be used. So we had developed it and trained the staff, did the training of the staff, so that they had a procedure to how to go about reporting these things and getting these cases moved down the road. And you definitely do have to have it. You got a new staff on the board, you got a new administrator, you've got to do it. And so what I don't want to come across saying, I'm not supporting what you're trying to do. I'm 100% behind what you're trying to do. I guess I have a problem about the issue of local control and how they can best determine it. I think that in the Juneau School District, we went about training staff how to deal with, observe, and report and do that process probably as well as any district has. And we did it before we ever, fortunately, we didn't hit the newspapers on it. But I think that what you're doing is you are, in fact, and will, in fact, you're mandating a state curriculum. Now, that's what you're doing by this thing, and I would hope that maybe you could find a way to take the mandatory 2 days out of there and bring it into a place so the districts have to deal with the issue. The legislature wants it dealt with, but that they have the latitude to deal with it the most effective way at the local level. I think I commend you on some of the other bills, and they're not the ones that are going to be testified on at this time. I talked to the assistant principals, and they're right in the middle of some of this, particularly junior high assistant principals. And they, right down the line, were concerned about the mandated 2 days time. I asked, how many of you have had any in-service in this in the last year? There was only one that had it out of about 40.
Had not.
So what I want you to understand is, some of it may have been, an emphasis may have happened because all of a sudden hit the newspapers there. But there are a lot of districts that have been dealing with, the Anchorage School District, and lots of districts have been dealing with this internally already. We know it's a problem, and we're certainly supportive of the thing that's going on there. They would like to see it not mandated, but they would like to encourage the legislature's support in this area.
Mr. McKinnon, tell me how the districts are dealing with it in their own fashion, if you will. Can you give us some examples of how that's being done in a variety of ways?
Well,
that we could
they may in fact provide the in-service, like in Juneau, we provide the in-service by having our own lawyer help develop the policy. Came in and provided the training for the teachers, dealt with the issue, had health and social service people come in and talk about it, even had a state trooper into some of the in-service that came in and talked about some of the issues and the concerns.
But that was an in-service.
We did it as an in-service, but we did not do it as a full 2-day in-service. We found we were more effective by using shorter blocks of time and getting somebody in there that would, like if we had an early dismissal and have a 2-hour in-service, as opposed to that and get the teachers for a shorter period of time, that was more effective, they preferred it too.
Mr. Gall?
Thank you. That is very, very nicely phrased in my opinion, because it demonstrates clearly why 2 days of solid in-service might just simply not be as practical from a teaching perspective as breaking it up along the lines that are suitable to the school system. However, as far as the school districts being able to develop a program themselves, for example, the program that you discussed clearly slants towards the reporting requirement and the urban setting where there are a variety of institutional frameworks available to respond once the teacher has done his or her legal responsibility. But in Pelican, that's not the case. And in Heidelberg, that's not the case. And in the other smaller communities of the state of Alaska, that's not the case, that these school systems have the capacity to even recruit the personnel necessary to provide the best kind of service. And why I say that, it's not, I don't mean to contradict you, because I think you're absolutely correct within the institutions that you've named, but some of these teachers are out there quite literally alone in, let's say, a logging camp. And for that teacher to only be looking at it from a legal or public safety perspective may often just mean not enough, because the internal dynamics of the community come into play. It's more so the case in the native communities, where the traditional affiliations within the community come into play, and so on. And you know precisely what I'm speaking of, I'm sure. So what I'm looking for from you would be a recommendation as to how to replace, the same question I asked of Steve Hull, how do we replace the time guideline, which I think is counterproductive, with some sort of guideline to ensure that the program take place, that it be sufficient, and that it be, you know, well-rounded and broad-based. And if this committee, or for the sake of argument, if this committee is unwilling to give that responsibility for conceptual design to the Department of Education, let us say that that be given to the school district, and the school district develop the design. Well, unfortunately, the school boards and their superintendent may or may not have themselves been adequately trained or educated to develop, you know, that system. So all of this is not to criticize your testimony, only to indicate that there are a variety of problems, as you know, and to get your recommendations on language that would structure this law or structure the guidelines within the law such that they would direct the school board or the superintendent to provide a program that would in fact give training both in identification and response sufficient to meet the local need. Do you have any suggestions?
I don't want to leave you with the intent that I support entirely a legal procedure.
I
spoke to that because that's the first thing we got into, because my staff got scared to death when all of a sudden the state trooper said he was going to charge him with something.
Right.
And they thought, you know, they just started the slow procedure, all of a sudden they found a problem.
See, what I'm speaking about are those communities where you're lucky to ever see a state trooper.
Well, and Jeremiah, I spent 8 years in the bush. And I know exactly what you're saying. They have access to people to come out and help train them. They can borrow. They could borrow somebody from the Juneau School District, or they could borrow somebody from another place. There are a lot of people. If the department starts putting, in the other bill you're talking about, the department starting to put something together, then they would go to the department and say, we need some in-service training for our people. I think you're on the right track of getting those things.
What would you say in the bill, is what I'm asking you? How would you phrase the bill to, you can't just say, at least what I've been hearing in the testimony and from the sponsor, you can't just say each school district shall provide in-service training for teachers on child abuse and sexual assault. You have to do something to make it a little more specific what it is you're requiring of these school districts. And I'm wondering if you have any recommendations.
I probably disagree with the committee on that and the sponsor. I don't believe that, number one, the teachers are going to allow, once they hear the ramification, if they don't get the training, that they're going to allow to let it fly, go without the training. Two, the community isn't going to allow them to it. I can tell you right now that the community that she's in is going to make doggone sure their teachers get the training across their thing. It's right up front now. They got it there. In the Juneau, they didn't allow it. I think that once people know it, so I have a lot more faith in the general public in the school districts and in the Department of Education, that if you just said that it shall be provided, or you shall provide it, that it will be done, just like you, like a variety of other subjects that you say that will take place. And you don't have to be any more specific in that, because it's going to happen. It isn't something you're going to go away from. You're not going to run from it, because you got to deal with it.
I follow you. Just a final follow-up then, if I might.
Mr. Gall,
thank you very much.
Brief.
I will.
I
understand. The concern that I had in the language of the bill prior to any of this discussion was provide training on the subjects of child abuse and child sexual assault. I'm wondering whether, in order, I accept what you say. I think if you go, personally, I think if you go to that school district and you say the law requires that you have a program on child abuse, that they will come up with something good, or at least the best that they can, and they'll use the sources that are available to them. However, do you think there should be any guidelines as to what it is that we are trying to get them to be trained to do, insofar as the phrase here, of course, is a very loose phrase and may be understood by everyone, but some suggestion has been made to me earlier that we ask for, you know, training in identification, intervention, and response, something like that, or prevention. You know, do you see any point in putting guidelines in the statutes of that sort?
Whether you do or not, that's what they're going to do the training in.
Just wanted your recommendation.
They're going to do the training there, and I can quickly say that we've got somebody from the teachers' organization here, and he's going to get the same message out to his people that if you haven't had a training, you better get it because the subject's hot, and you're open to liability.
Thank you, Mr. McKinnon. We appreciate your testimony.
I have one thing, if I may, because I have to go back as a swim meet director. That's going on right now for a statewide swim meet, and I would just like to say that I'm totally in support of the next one you're going to be hearing, and I wanted to get that on the record because I've been through that as a superintendent. I had the bad apple passed on to me after two, can you believe, twice, and the third time in Cordova came up where we actually had a staff member, and I absolutely agree with it. It's absolutely essential. The better we can do it and the harder we do it, the better on it, because that is a real problem.
I'll make sure that it gets on the record when we hear that bill.
Thank you,
Mr. McKinnon. Mr. Jan Still, please.
Yes.
Mr. Still, you are going to be electronically recorded for your testimony, so please state your name for the record.
Yes, my name is Jan Still. I live in Douglas, Alaska, and I'm representing the Alaskan Citizens for Families. It's a small group in Anchorage, in Juneau and Fairbanks. And the I don't think we have any problem with the intent of the bill. I think what our real concern is what's going to be taught during the in-service training. And I think that there's a lot of misinformation as far as sexual abuse statistics. And I got a large amount of material from Representative Lacker a couple days ago. And I went through it, and a lot of the material is contradictory. A lot of the studies don't seem to be real scientific studies. They're somebody, you know, writing a series of papers with really no background or no authority. And there are a lot of statistics being quoted today concerning sexual abuse that don't seem to be correct. One point that in the last hearing that we had concerning sexual abuse of the admissibility of testimony as far as hearsay testimony, somebody from our Gail Horsky made the statement that a typical profile of a sexual abuser would be somebody that's authoritarian, that's a member of the military or the police department. And it may have included, I heard that part, somebody said she also included fundamentalist religious groups. Now, I think that is an example of the kind of misinformation that I wouldn't want my child to hear. And I think that it can't be backed up. And I think if you're teaching this to the teachers, it's going to get back down to the children eventually. I also talked to Representative Lacker considering the 1 in 4 statistic about 1 in 4 girl children are sexually abused. And one statement she made to me, and this is roughly a direct quote, "We need to get rid of the idea that children belong to the parent and that a man's house is his castle. If this was done, we would eliminate 50% of sexual abuse of children."
Madam Chairman.
Ms. Lacker.
That is not a direct quote.
I wrote that down roughly as you were telling me.
That is not a direct quote, because I have made that statement on more than one occasion, and we must get rid of the idea that children belong to their families to do with as they please. And I also followed that up, that children are placed in our care to care for. They are not our property to use. And a man's home is not his castle to do anything he pleases. That is my direct quote, and I've made it many times. I would suggest that unless you tape me, you may have pulled what jumped out at you. And it is a very scary quote, but that is what causes a great percentage of sexual abuse of minors. I mean, people pretty much don't get as involved if a man sexually abuses one of his own children as they would if he went up the street and took my child or Mr. Gall's child. That really gets people mad. But and it's kind of like either like inter-family murder. It's not quite so terrible to the community. It doesn't frighten them quite so bad, because at least you don't have somebody on the loose going to kill someone. You have someone who got really mad at a relative, and that's not doesn't seem to be so bad in our society.
Continue, Mr. Stowe.
Yes, I might add, I was going to add, you also said children are a precious responsibility, which I don't think anyone would dispute. That's certainly the case. After I talked to you, I talked to Ray Clements of Parents United. It's apparently a state-supported group in Anchorage. And he stated that he didn't have any statistics to base the fact that the police are the military were any worse sexual abusers than anybody else. But he also has literature that say that 1 in 4 families, now this is different than what we've heard before, 1 in 4 families, that sexual misuse is found in 1 out of 4 families. Now, the thing I've noticed, a constant pattern in the literature that I've gotten from you and other people on sexual abuse, is these things are never referenced. There's no scientific study to back it up. The statement is made apparently by somebody that's authoritative. And I question the 1 out of 4 families has a problem with sexual abuse. I don't think that that's true. I've talked to a lot of people. In their experience, that doesn't seem to be true. And I think you have to get to the truth of the matter. And the thing is, I would like to, if you're going to quote statistics, there ought to be a source. There ought to be some indication of just how those statistics were derived. And I've read a lot of the studies. In some cases, the people that participate in studies are paid for their information. There's a whole array of them. I think the whole detail, all the details are really needed. There are problems that parents have with the Division of Family and Youth Services in this whole reporting spectrum. And some of the things that people have told me, and it's been my experience with the Division of Family and Youth Services, that the sexual abuse laws are being used to grind other axes. And some of the things, the complaints that they're used to attack certain groups, that social workers are hostile to groups such as religious groups, police, authoritative parents or husbands. And I think that, or the other thing is just parents that spank their children. And I have some documentation on that. I've got a letter from a social worker that criticizes a lady for spanking her children. And I think, you know, that we should be very careful of the kind of things that we teach, the teachers that we're going to teach our children. And certainly, I don't want my child, you know, taught some of the things that I've heard here at this hearing. And I've heard people say that, you know, if that's the case, they're going to take their children out of school. And I would, you know, seriously, I think, you know, that's a serious consideration. There are a lot of people, let's say from the fundamentalist groups, if this thing, if they're perceived in these programs as sexual abusers, that they're not going to have their kids going to school and have them taught things like that. That's all I have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Steele. Before I acknowledge Mr. Gall and Barbara, you mentioned that you were with Alaska Citizens for Families.
Yes.
And then you also mentioned Parents United.
Parents United I'm not part of that group. It's a group apparently sponsored by the Division of Family and Youth Services, and maybe you know.
I just want to know their source.
And it's out of Anchorage. I have the phone number at home. I have some of their literature right here. It's where I got the 1 in 4 families.
I just wanted to make a comment about your testimony. It's not too often that someone comes before this committee or probably other committees that says, you know, look at your statistics and try to validate them. And it startled me to hear that, and it jerked me back into reality to the degree that many people spew out statistics and everyone, I think as your testimony was attempting to say, seems to latch on to figures and place them in the factual realm without justification, and I take your recommendations to heart, Mr. Steele, because we too often do that. There are so many statisticians and so many consultants these days that one is to believe only them, and I thank you for that. I thank you very much for making mention of that so that we are more cautious in believing or disbelieving facts and figures. Mr. Gall, you are next, and then Barbara.
Thank you. I'm barraged with misinformation on a daily basis from my colleagues and public. Sometimes through no fault of their own, and sometimes through their own fault. But I think the issue here is a little different. We all know for a fact, at least I know for a fact, that there's a serious problem with child abuse and child sexual assault in this state, just as there's a serious problem of alcohol abuse in this state that is. And for that matter, we have more people in jail in this state per capita than any place except Russia and the Union of South Africa. We've got some real serious problems here with social misconduct. One of those problems is child abuse, and no matter how I would like to avoid it, I'm confronted with it on a daily basis. I hear from constituents some pretty horrible stories, and the big problem seems not to be my perception. The big problem that I'm encountering is not misinformation, but how to deal with the problem when it does occur. You know, not false problems. I'm sure they do occur. I'm sure people use the child abuse, you know, laws the same way they use the disorderly conduct laws, you know, to say that that person this or that. I can't respond to your comments. What I do know is that there's a problem. What I do know is that we have to come up with the most responsible way of addressing it, whatever that is. And I think that's what you're saying too, if I understand you correctly, that the idea of having teachers aware of the problem and able to respond is a good idea. But what is it that they're going to be responding to, and what is it that they're going to be told? These are very, very important questions. And what I'd appreciate from you would be your recommendation on this particular statute, because what I think you heard in the last half hour has indicated to you probably that there's a great reluctance on the part of the school boards, even the Department of Education, which is a state agency, the superintendents, great reluctance to see the state mandate not only the specifics of the program, but even the number of hours that the program is to take. So what we'll end up with, if this bill passes into law, will be the local school boards responsible to their local public making decisions as to how to implement such a program. And so my question to you would be, given those facts, that we do have a problem, that we do want people to be able to address the problem, and that we as a state, you or me, will have no real control over what is said in those meetings. I mean, if somebody walks in and knows something and makes a comment, it may be the right comment, it may be the wrong comment, we're not going to be able to say, you may not give false statistics. We just have to hope that they don't. But what would you suggest? This is what we have to deal with here. We have to deal with a bill that will require the schools to provide training to their teachers in responding to sexual abuse when they see it, when it occurs, when they feel it, that they're justified. I think you'd find the cross-section of the teachers you're dealing with will be a cross-section of the public. Some of them will think spanking is good, some of them will think spanking is bad. What would you recommend that we do on this particular bill to respond to your concerns?
I think that,
sorry.
You know, I think it's, I think,
excuse
you know, really
me, Mr.
It's
Steele,
a
before
problem.
We go any further, Mr. Gall, I thank you for your editorializing, but we've got several more.
So when you speak to the witness,
would you please get to the point so we can go on?
I'll make an effort within the scope of my duties.
I think somehow, you know, and I'm not an attorney, so I can't really say that we narrow the scope of what's being taught. In other words, we're talking about abuse of children. Maybe just ordinary spanking. Parents shouldn't be criticized for that. I run into a whole array of people that that I've talked to that have a lot of problems with social workers and maybe to a certain extent educators sort of passing judgment on the way they're raising their family. And things that have nothing to do with social with sexual abuse or child abuse come in into consideration for that. And I think kind of I get the impression that the law is being used to grind some of their acts. In other words, somebody doesn't like conservatives, maybe somebody doesn't like police or the military, and they just use this here to get at these other groups. You know, I think there has to be some restriction on what's taught.
Do you have any recommendation for this statute?
So I can't make a specific recommendation. If an attorney could say we could limit it to so-and-so would make the policy. I think I'm not clear. I think the school board determines who's going to do the in-service training, which I think is good if it has some local control. I can see some advantage to the local control or something like that, but I would like to see something in the statute that would limit the scope of what is taught.
Barbara?
Yes, Madam Chairman. Number one, statistics can be used to make any point that you wish to make, and legislators know that better than anybody, but so can things be taken out of context and made to sound to defend a position or offend a position. And so I do need at this time to state very clearly that Gail Horetzky testified before this committee, and only after many questions by the chairman regarding what kind of person most often does this sort of thing, did she throw out, well, quite often the person will be this type. And so it certainly was not a professional testimony offered as this is the sort of person you have to watch out for, but only in response to the chairman's question about what are traits about these people that you notice more often. And so I don't think that anyone, at least at this committee, is trying to go out and get fundamentalists or policemen or anyone else and attack them with this sexual abuse legislation. I would also like to say that one other thing that you failed to quote me on is that I had many, many statistics that I shared with this gentleman, and I said, I hope you can find something wrong with these statistics. Please work on it, because I hate to think that they exist. I don't like to believe them. I can say that the statistics were drawn from many different areas, and that I had hoped that you would at least even take one of them and actually back it up with the scientific fact that they were in fact not true, because I, more than anyone, want to believe that 1 in 4 is not a figure that we're forced to deal with. But based on what I've read, it's very, very real, and one that we do have to look at anyway, Madam Chairman.
It's hard to go through somebody else's research and say and scientifically prove their research is wrong. The only thing you can do is look through and see if they, in fact, have scientifically produced their results. And I've noticed in a lot of these studies that there's really no science at all. There's about as much science as astrology in some of them. Some people have attempted to make a random sample, which really is necessary for a study like this. I deal a little bit in statistics where I work, so I know a little bit about it, enough to know that most of the studies are somebody's opinion. And frankly, you know, I think if we're going to get at the heart of the matter, there's got to be some kind of a random sample to get an idea of what's going on.
Mr. Coffman, do you have a question? Thank you very much, Mr. Steele. We appreciate your testimony. Barbara Nichols? Nichols? Correct me if I mispronounce your name.
It's Nicholas.
Nicholas, for the record, you are going to be electronically recorded, so please state your name.
My name is Barbara Nicholas, and I'm Executive Director for the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And I just wanted you to know that the Council supports this legislation, and we think it's very crucial. And that is the kind of the bottom line of things that the teachers need to know about. One of them is their legal reporting requirements. The other are the physical and behavioral symptoms of child abuse, which includes child sexual abuse. And then the last thing would be how to respond if a child discloses to a teacher. And I think that those are the basic minimums that each educator has to know. I would also like, we've already known about problems, and we've talked about problems in the state that have arisen because of lack of knowledge about reporting requirements. And I wanted to comment that in the statute that requires teachers to report, it also holds them harmless if they have reported in good faith. And so there's protection in the statute. And the statute is Alaska Statute 47-17-020. And it says, As far as the reporting, it says school teachers are required to immediately report to the Department of Health and Social Services if in their professional duties they have cause to believe that a child has suffered harm as a result of abuse or neglect. And the statute also says that they are held harmless. I would like to mention, as far as some of the things that are happening statewide, the council funds 19 programs throughout the state, and 14 of those programs deal directly or indirectly with child sexual assault. And some of the programs deal with other forms of child abuse, but the focus is more on child sexual assault for the council-funded programs. And these programs work with the schools, and some of the things that you've heard about, for instance, the Anchorage School District, the reason that they have in services in the Anchorage School District is that STAR, which is a council-funded program in Anchorage, has worked for the last 3 years developing and implementing a curriculum in the school district. Karen Robinson is going to be speaking for AWARE. She's the director of the program here in Juneau, and AWARE has worked equally as hard implementing a curriculum in the school district. But these two school districts are the exceptions, and they're not necessarily the rule. The rest of the programs that the council funds, at least the rest of the 14, have worked with their school districts and have wanted to provide expertise to the school districts so that they would have information about child sexual assault, but their efforts have not been as aggressive as STARS and AWARE's. I would just like to say that, and that's one thing that the council feels very strongly about, is that if and when this is implemented in the school districts, that they do continue to work very closely with the sexual assault programs that the council funds in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions of the witness? Hearing none, thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony.
Oh, I would like to give you something. I almost forgot.
Oh,
this is something when Karen talks, she's going to be mentioning this, but this is a bulletin that's put out by Rape Relief in Seattle in King County. And this is something that the council distributes statewide, and it gives some information about child sexual assault that you might be interested in.
Thank you very much for that. Next on our list is Gail Goretzky, please.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gail Goretzky. I'm with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. I know the hour's late, and I'll be very brief, Madam Chairman. On behalf of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, I would encourage the committee members to pass legislation of this sort. It's obviously up to you whether that's 1 day or 2 years or, you know, I think that a clear statement by the legislature and by this committee that training of this sort needs to be done, the exact number and the exact method I think can be left, you know, to the discretion of those who are familiar with those training methods. As a prosecutor and person who worked with these cases extensively, we found that in many, many cases, when cases ultimately did come to our attention, a child may have been abused for a long period of time, months, in some cases even years, and that as the investigation progressed and things came to light, that there were signs that should have been clear to professional educators who would have had training in this area that should have tipped them off that something was wrong. Excessive absences, crying in school, inappropriate behavior, sexual suggestiveness to the other students or to the teachers. When a child acts out in that way, something is wrong. Not necessarily child abuse, certainly in every case, but a teacher who was trained to notice these symptoms and signs could certainly pick up on them and make an effort to have the school counselor talk to the child or the nurse and find out what's going on at home or, you know, is there a drinking problem or what. It would, in my opinion, encourage early reporting, effective investigation, and certainly the prevention of continued abuse if teachers were more aware both of the signs and symptoms to look for, the prevalence of the problem, and their legal reporting requirements. The fact that the gentleman here from the Board of Education said, I think that practically speaking they are immunized. He certainly wasn't wrong, of course, but the statute specifically says they are immunized for good faith reporting. That was just one minor example of how people do need to be educated to what the reporting requirements are and what protections are afforded to them under the law if they report in good faith.
Thank you, Gail. Mr. Davis?
Yeah, thanks. I concur with what your remarks. I was just curious on this proposed committee substitute. If we could, if you have some language that would somehow spell out that they would actually have some kind of in-service training, but maybe not say that it had to have to be 4 hours or 8 hours, 16 hours, or whatever. If you had some proposed language change, we could work with you. It'd be interesting.
Madam Chairman, Representative Davis, I think language of that sort would be fairly easy to come up with. Off the top of my head, you could say each school district shall include 2 days of in-service training with teachers on the subjects of child abuse and sexual abuse of minors. That training shall include the symptoms to look for which may indicate child abuse, reporting requirements, possible liability, perhaps treatment if that would be appropriate, prevention. You could list the things that you would want the curriculum to focus on and not say 4 hours of this or 2 hours of that, but just say any in-service training developed shall at a minimum touch these areas, and then just list them.
Okay. Isn't it, we've just heard testimony from Mr. McKinnon, who represents the Superintendent's Association,
mm-hmm.
that in fact is being done as a policy already in all the school districts. Would that be necessary to include?
That's a judgment for this committee. I'm sure that they're operating in good faith. I totally agree with Ms. Nicholas's testimony that you have a very uneven value from district to district. Not that anyone has a bad motive. It just may be the person in charge, what their awareness is, what funds they have to work with, etc. I think in your smaller and more isolated districts, you probably have more of a problem in some ways, but you have less attention focused by the teachers than you do in a more metropolitan area such as Juneau or Anchorage. That's my personal opinion. I don't, you know, I haven't done a survey. I don't know for sure. If that's
Madam
right.
Chairman?
Mr. Davis?
So your recommendation to the committee is that they do have 2 days, but you aren't going to spell out?
No, sir, not necessarily. I think in some places you might need more, in some places less. I do agree that, you know, individual differences from district to district probably should be taken into account.
So what you're saying is that they should spell out the things that are included within the curriculum, or at least some minimum number of things, but not, so you just say that there would be in-service training on these subjects and then list them, but not spell out how many days or if it took 6 days.
That's up to the committee. That's
but
really
I just want to know your recommendation on that. That's fine. Thank you, Gail.
Thank you, Gail. Next person we have on our list for testimony is Carla Temple.
I think I wrote down that I would just go with Sarah.
Oh, thank
I'm
you
sorry.
Very much, Carla.
8 hours.
And another person then we have is Bob Manners.
Yeah. That would make that 2 hours.
Mr. Manners, for the record, you'll be electronically recorded, so please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Bob Manners, NEA Alaska. NEA Alaska supports this legislation, and we're glad to see that the title has been expanded to include the concept of child abuse as well. Most of what I would have to say has already been stated by previous witnesses, but I do want to emphasize a couple points. Probably 2 days of in-service annually would not be as efficiently used if it were block time, as requiring each school district to have some sort of a plan which incorporates in-service and perhaps reinforcement or refresher as a part of regular building faculty meetings, so regular subgroup meetings of the staff of the district on a periodic basis, and simply make sure that that plan is an annual activity. To presume that once a person has been in service on this issue and has no need for further in-servicing, I think is doing the attention to the problem of this service, and so we would encourage that there be some sort of reinforcement. The other thing that I think is appropriate is to suggest that this be expanded to be applicable to all employees of the school district who have regular contact with children in a supervisory way. Teacher aides, I think, have the opportunity to recognize potential for the problem, so restricting it to just teachers and principals might be unnecessarily or too restrictive in terms of potentially dealing with the issue. The other thing that we suggest is that there be a closer tie between the school district and the agencies to deal with the resolution of the problem, so that those services are more immediately or directly or quickly available to deal with the solution to the problem when the situation has been identified. Representative Gall had asked earlier, and I think Barbara stated pretty concisely what the in-service ought to be, and that would be the recognition of symptoms, knowing the reporting requirements, and knowing how to initially respond. However, the issue suggests that there's another concern that I think needs to be dealt with, and that's the community sensitivity to the fact that the schools have a role in the problem or in the issue, but they can only do so much. I think there's a tendency from time to time for public schools to become the place where you solve a lot of different kinds of social problems, and the final resolution or the service to the child that's a victim is not going to necessarily be with the school system, but with the agency that provides the support and the counseling mechanisms. Finally, Representative Festinger had earlier asked about the integrity of the reporting process. And as employees, I'd be less than honest if I didn't suggest that there is a level of paranoia or concern about reporting and whether or not the confidentiality, even though it's explicitly implied or stated, is necessarily always there. And in fact, a problem that we encounter from time to time is an internal ad hoc reporting process of the district, the internal reporting process, which I think causes employees to be less than anxious to necessarily make a report, only because it does intrude into their concern about job security. And so I think it's incumbent upon the system to make sure that that process is a sacred process that is confidential, that is protected. With that, I'll stop, and if I can respond to the question, I'll try to do so.
Before I can get a question, Mr. Gall, would you suggest that or concur with, and as you touched upon local control to some degree, that a plan for this in-service teaching be under the purview of the school board, so that the school board would have the final say on what plan is going to be implemented in the school?
I think it's their obligation, yes.
Of course, and if we state that in this legislation, it's going to be very clear that whatever plan there is or is offered is reviewed by and approved, or maybe they'll initiate the plan, but at least that would be very broad in concept to the determination of what other resources are available. That delegation then of information could be given to the teachers through the school board, through the principal, saying that these are the outside resources that you said would be good to be connected with, rather than mandate specific resources in legislation, some of which may not be available in certain districts, which would be a very unfortunate situation. The legislature might be forced to supply those local services in areas that normally would not be have enough population to support that sort of thing.
Well, as you can say, Madam Chairman, that in the other bill that's in this committee, the Department of Education is requested to develop and implement that plan and make it available to all school districts. So that way, I guess the legislature would have some assurance that at least a minimal state-approved plan was available to the school districts. And make no mistake that every school board has the final authority of what comes into that district to be taught.
But if we spell that out so that there be no question, if the Department of Education produce the plan and make it available, it would intimate that the school board must take that recommendation without purview. Maybe they want to add something, maybe they want to subtract something, and to fine-tune it to their own specific needs in their district, rather than have an overall plan that might apply very nicely to like a metropolitan area, but have no relevancy whatsoever in Pelican or in Kotzebue or in Kuskokwim or some other small district. My thought was to make sure that you say something that deals on the issue. Mr. Gall,
thank you.
I'm going to give you about
each
one
school
minute.
District, are you? I'm sorry, what did you say you're going
to
do? What?
I'll try to give you about a minute because we need to discuss some of the amendments that we've hope to be putting on this bill.
I see. Okay. Thank you for the guidance.
We have one more bill to do.
Each school district, you say that it should include not just principals and teachers, but all staff members who are supervising students. What exact phrase would you recommend? Staff members who are doing what? You want to say supervising? You want to say in regular contact? What would you recommend? Regular contact
probably is the term.
How about janitors? They're in regular contact with them all the time.
A school bus driver supervises students to a certain extent periodically.
Would that cover something like that?
I think so.
Well, now, let's say for the sake of argument, then, we can always debate it, regular contact. I was wondering if you would comment, and I would appreciate the thoughts of the other members of the committee. It seems to me that everybody who has spoken today supports the intent of the bill, that teachers should know what they're doing in this subject. And the major objection has been either to do it, not to do it every other year, it should be every year, we shouldn't require 2 days of in-service, it's too restrictive, etc. It seems to me that what is intended here is about 8 hours per year of training. And that in order to make that most effective, that training might logically be broken up into a 2-hour film, a 1-hour seminar, a 4-hour this or whatever, and may or may not require the use of those in-service days, provided that the amount of training is provided. So